Well, thank you for the invitation to give this seminar today. Today I'm going to talk about some recent work that we've done in this paper listed here. This is work done with my postdoc, Aaron Friedman, and two PhD students, Chow Yin and Yifan Hong. Just a sort of quick outline of what I want to say, you know, you can feel free to interrupt with questions or complaints if you have them. I'll sort of start by introducing locality in quantum mechanics as captured by Lieb-Robinson bounds. Then I'll talk about adding measurements to this story and kind of summarize our results. Then the meat of the talk most likely will be this third section on the Steinspring formalism, where I'll try to give you what I think is a really beautiful picture for thinking about error-corrected quantum dynamics with measurements. We'll have a sort of Heisenberg picture and talk about operator growth in the presence of measurements, and this will allow us to sort of prove the locality bounds that I'll describe. Then I'll sort of highlight briefly some applications of these locality bounds to preparing a whole zoo of states that people care about, and then kind of wrap up. Let me begin with some introductory comments. Probably the first time in physics that we see a locality bound or some notion that, you know, everything, including information, has to travel with a finite or can't travel faster than some critical velocity, is just in relativity, right? In relativity, we say that information can't travel faster than the speed of light c, because if it did, then two space-like separated events could influence each other, and, you know, then there would exist a reference frame where the future influenced the past. And so in relativity, Einstein sort of demanded this very stringent speed limit that absolutely no information can travel faster than the speed of light. And you might think at first glance that this is kind of in tension with what we know about quantum mechanics, where there's this spooky measurement. Of course, that will be sort of the theme of the talk later on. But it turns out that even in quantum mechanics, Einstein's original sort of vision of, you know, strict locality continues to hold. In quantum field theory, what this means is that in a relativistic system, if you give me two local operators at different points in space-time, then they will commute if the space-time points are space-like separated. Okay. And I'll sort of point out in examples a little later why, if this criterion were violated, we would indeed send information faster than the speed of light. Okay. Now, you know, for the purposes of this talk, we're mostly not interested in relativity, in relativistic dynamics. But even in non-relativistic dynamics, there can be an emergent notion of locality in quantum systems. And this was first realized in 1972 by Lieb and Robinson. I think this work was probably sort of forgotten for a long time, at least in the physics community, but it was revived by Hastings and Coma and Nachtergale and Sims about 17, 18 years ago. What the Lieb-Robinson bound says sort of formally is this kind of technical commutator bound that I've written here. But the physical setup is that I start with some Hamiltonian that's local. And for today, we'll focus on 1D systems for simplicity. So I have some local spin chain in one dimension. You know, I have on-site fields and nearest neighbor couplings. And I claim that, you know, if I then evolve under this Hamiltonian for some time t, the information will travel at some finite velocity v, which is in sort of physical units, the Hopping strength times the lattice spacing divided by h bar. In physical units, this typically is a few orders of magnitude below the actual speed of light. So this is a physical effect. It's not a sort of, you know, mathematical idea, but unimportant in practice. This really does matter in real systems. First, let me sort of talk about why this kind of funny commutator bound needs to be true, and then I'll remark on the next page about why this sort of tells us something about how quickly information can be transmitted. So why this bound has to be true in the first place, this follows from thinking explicitly about the growth in the operator A naught. So here, imagine A and B are sort of polymatrices with A on site zero, B on site L. If I evolve A in time, okay, I can formally, at least for a time independent Hamiltonian, just Taylor expand A naught of T. For time dependent problems, that's more annoying, but the principle is sort of the same. If I look at this Taylor series, right, these first terms, which dominate at small times, cannot contribute to this commutator. And the reason is that A naught is a local poly operator. It acts, you know, on spin zero. And it obviously will commute with a poly on spin L. In order for this pair of operators not to commute, I need to find a string of polys in A naught of T that acts non-trivially on site L, then it might fail to commute with BL. But I need to add, I need to have a lot of terms in my Taylor series. Basically, I need to commute with a lot of coefficients in the Hamiltonian in order to grow a poly string that can act on site L. And you can sort of see why in the cartoon at the bottom. So if I start with a poly on site A naught, it has to grow first to site one, and then at some point later to site two. And I just have to keep sort of hopping sequentially until I hit the L minus one to L coupling. And then at long last, I can not commute with BL. And you just sort of have to bound how large those terms can be. There are more and less sophisticated ways to do that. But at the end of the day, you find that A and B almost commute if VT is smaller than L, where V is this emergent Lieb-Robinson velocity. Okay. Now, these Lieb-Robinson bounds really constrain almost anything useful that you would want to do in quantum mechanics. And to give a sort of example that I'll harp on for much of the talk, suppose I start with some unentangled qubits, and the left one encodes one qubit worth of information. Then one through L are just in some trivial state. And then I want to evolve the system under some unitary dynamics for time t. And at the end of this process, I want to entangle the left and right qubits in some Bell pair. And for pedagogical reasons, I want this Bell pair to actually encode a qubit. This is, I think, instructive for thinking about these locality bounds. I don't really care what the remaining qubits are doing, but the left and right one had better be entangled. Now, there's a sort of nice thought experiment that we can do to think of why operators need to really grow to be non-local. So imagine that, you know, I want to apply maybe first a logical Z, so flip the sign of beta. And then at some later point, I want to apply a logical X, so kind of flip alpha and beta. But I want to apply the Z, you know, before evolving the system from the sort of unentangled state to the Bell pair. And then I'll apply the X after I have the entangled state, and I want to apply, sorry, I think the Z and X are backwards in my equation, but yeah, I want to apply an X, I think, on the single qubit, and then evolve in time, and then apply a logical Z. And since the logical X and Z at time zero are just single poly strings, but the logical Z at the final time is Z naught times ZL, you can sort of see that the logical Z, which is a single poly string at time zero, has to grow into a two site, albeit a very non-local two site polystring at the final time. And then sort of trivially, the final polystring will fail to commute with the initial one. And so the qubit logical X became a non-local operator when evolving in time. And this sort of is why the Lieb-Robinson bound constrains preparing this Bell pair. So typos, if these formulas aside, the Lieb-Robinson bound both constrains this Bell pair preparation time, but also many, many other sort of tasks of interest. If you want to bound the size of correlation functions, these are controlled by Lieb-Robinson bounds and the Lieb-Robinson velocity. Lieb-Robinson velocities tell us how easy a system is to simulate, either with classical or quantum computers. They give us bounds on the time to prepare interesting topological phases or states, in those phases. They can even give us correlation lengths in gapped ground states, which is sort of what popularized these in the 2000s. In recent years, just to sort of advertise some other work that I've been doing, there's really been a huge amount of progress on extending Lieb-Robinson bounds from these kind of local spin chain models to increasingly sophisticated systems. So we can do Lieb-Robinson bounds for dissipative dynamics. More recently, we can prove locality with power law interactions. So if I give you a Hamiltonian with this kind of 1 over r to the alpha interaction, it turns out when alpha is larger than 2d plus 1, there's a finite Lieb-Robinson velocity. Okay, so no signals can be sent. It's as if you have a local system. When alpha is smaller than 2d plus 1, it turns out you can actually send information at sort of velocities that diverge as t goes to infinity. And that divergence will be algebraic when alpha is above 2d, and it will grow exponentially. The velocity will grow exponentially with time below 2d. And that story was sort of resolved in a series of many papers over the past 3 years. A little more recently, we've managed to prove a finite sort of velocity in the Bose-Hubbard model. So if you give me a finite density state of the Bose-Hubbard model, I cannot send signals arbitrarily fast. And this is more maybe a mathematical physics challenge than a physically surprising result, but we were able to prove this rigorously last year. Okay. Maybe I can pause for if there are any questions before I move on. Okay. So if not, then the goal of this talk is to describe how these Lieb-Robinson bounds generalize if we start adding measurements into the dynamics, or to describe the extent to which the Lieb-Robinson theorem can be generalized to systems with measurement. Okay. This is actually a sort of old puzzle in quantum mechanics, right? So Einstein himself was very unhappy about this interplay between measurement and speed limits on information in quantum mechanics. And there was a concern, back 90 years ago, that the wave function collapse in quantum mechanics could be used to basically violate causality in relativity. And the thought experiment, at least the way I'll tell it, is that I start with some Bell pair shared between, parties A and B separated by distance L. Let me just say for convenience that this Bell pair has alpha equals 1, beta equals 0. And then the question is, can A essentially send information faster than the speed of light by just measuring half of this Bell pair with B sort of instantly afterwards measuring their half of the Bell pair? Will the fact that these two parties always agree on measurement outcomes sort of break causality? And our sort of modern understanding is that obviously This is not a problem. One reason this is not a problem is that the outcome of A's measurement is random, as is B's, right? They're correlated, but there's no way for A and B to know sort of a priori what measurement outcome they have. And in fact, even if I didn't know, for example, whether I gave you the alpha or the beta bell pair, I still wouldn't know which one I had if I'm observer B until after I receive A's signal telling me what A measured. But since A's signal propagates at the speed of light, nothing travels faster than the speed of light. So that's sort of our modern resolution of the old paradox. But in a non-relativistic world where C is infinite and this classical measurement outcome can be transmitted instantly, it really seems like the measurement completely breaks locality. As one example, if I take this bell pair and I flip the first or the zero qubit, so the left end, and then I make a measurement here denoted schematically with M, the state that I get out will be the same as if I first measured and then flip X, okay, but now on site L. And so that local measurement on site zero sort of genuinely allows me to do something very non-local, far away, right? And this is sort of scary because the Lieb-Robinson bounds are really statements about all states in Hilbert space. So even if I give you a bell pair, okay, the Lieb-Robinson bound holds on a commutator. It tells me that matrix elements of this commutator are small, even in highly entangled states. But it seems like in the presence of measurement, even maybe putting aside that measurement is kind of violent and breaks normalization and so on, we might think that even one measurement can completely break locality in quantum mechanics. In fact, right, that's sort of why this bell pair is a useful resource state to begin with, that it does allow us to, you know, measure one qubit and teleport information far away. But we might say that, well, you know, this bell pair wasn't easy to create it in the first place, right? With unitary dynamics, we had to wait for the Lieb-Robinson light cone to pass in order to start with a product state and end up with a bell pair. And so maybe we think, well, is it possible that the Lieb-Robinson bound can hold even in the presence of measurements? You know, maybe we can say, once we have this bell pair, we can do something non-local. But if we start with a product state, for example, or some kind of locally entangled state, is it the case that there's still some notion of locality that you can't speed up an interesting information theoretic task, you know, by just using a few measurements and then teleporting a qubit some thermodynamic distance away? So that's sort of the main question for today. And the answer is that this is indeed the case. So if I start with unentangled qubits for simplicity, then if I'm willing to use the outcomes of M local measurements to perform error correction, then I can transmit information a distance L in time T when M plus one times VT is larger than L. And here and later in this talk, I'm being lazy about order one factors, so keep that in mind. But in a nutshell, what this theorem says is that it is possible, the best you can do is use M measurement outcomes to perform error correction. And then you might get to enhance the Lieb-Robinson velocity by this factor M plus one. Okay.
Indeed, can I ask a question?
Sure.
So you can always view a measurement as like a unitary interaction with an apparatus or something, right? So, I mean, is it possible to just apply the original Lieb-Robinson bounds to understand this, or do you need new arguments?
Well, I mean, in a sense, that's what I will describe later on, that you can, but you have to be careful about how you use. I would argue that, yes, you can think in that way, but it still requires maybe some thought to get this to work. But I'll describe this in some detail later in the talk, sort of how to understand this theorem and kind of this so-called Steinspring formalism, which will allow us to indeed sort of have some unitary picture for the dynamics that allows us to derive a Lieb-Robinson bound. But it's a bit non-trivial for reasons that I'll describe later, because if you're too sloppy, like if you just look for a Lieb-Robinson bound like the one that I opened with, that will not obey this theorem. You can make one measurement and do something very non-local. So it is important that we actually want to do something useful to get this theorem. And yeah, I'll describe sort of more what I mean by that as we go. So measurements can be very disruptive. That's easy, but to do something useful is difficult. And you can speed up tasks with measurement, but not arbitrarily fast. Or rather, you have to use a sort of unbounded number of measurements, you know, to speed up a task by an arbitrarily large factor. Okay. And this theorem is optimal, okay? Again, with the order one caveat, you cannot do better than this. And you can't do better than this no matter what you try. You can try to use continuous time dynamics rather than circuits. You can try to use some kind of feed forward where you make clever measurements at intermediate stages and then modify the unitary dynamics based on those outcomes. No matter what you try, you cannot beat this bound. So in this sense, it sort of has the generality and strength of the standard Lieb-Robinson bounds. The sort of weakness in this bound is this starting with unentangled qubits phrase. Okay, so we do need somewhat stronger conditions than Lieb and Robinson to derive this result. And what I think is sort of remarkable is that this result is actually saturated by a 25-year-old protocol, which I'll now describe. So what people have been trying to do for a long time turns out to be optimal. So let me describe a sort of process that can indeed kind of enhance the Lieb-Robinson velocity by a factor of m plus one. This is called the quantum repeater. I think in our paper, we call it the ESTP, but I'll just call it the repeater, sort of inspired by a quantum optics protocol by that name. Okay, so the goal is that I start with a qubit on the left end of my spin chain, and I want to teleport that qubit to the right end of the spin chain. In that process, and we'll see this is very important as we go through the talk, I'm in general going to sort of ruin at least some fraction of the qubits kind of in one through L. So I'm not going to be able to end up with all zeros tensor my original qubit. I'm going to need to like mess up the ones in the middle. But if I'm willing to pay that price, then I can indeed enhance the Lieb-Robinson velocity by m plus one using measurement. And there's a very simple picture for how. So let me imagine just for simplicity that I don't even bother to move the qubit on zero at early times. Instead, what I do is I grow some bell pairs kind of equally spaced down the chain. And you know, maybe in the first time step, I grow these bell pairs, so denoted here with these little red, barbells. And then as time increases, moving up, I just use unitary dynamics to kind of pull the qubits on each end of the bell pair apart. So I try to grow them as fast as possible. And at some time, right, two different bell pairs will have qubits on adjacent sites. When that happens, I stop the unitary dynamics and I make measurements on in a so-called bell basis. It's sort of like a two poly measurement on those bell pairs. And you can do this in a way that basically swaps the entanglement pattern. So it takes the center two qubits from a pair of bells and puts them into a bell pair. And then the outer two qubits themselves get entangled into a bell pair. And now I can just measure all of these sort of touching bell pairs. And at the end of this process, right, I'll have one very long range bell pair and then a bunch of short range ones. I've been able to beat the Leib-Robinson bound, right? Because now I've grown this very long range bell pair, but the time I had to wait was only the time for the smaller bell pairs to grow by basically 1/m of the total distance if I'm using m measurements. So that means the velocity basically is enhanced by a factor m. And then if I want, I can sort of play this trick one more time to teleport the original qubit, you know, from the left to the right by making one final bell measurement on the left end. But schematically, this is sort of the idea. In circuit notation, here is the circuit, the unitary circuit that implements this. And let me emphasize that in this circuit, we're drawing that you really have to use the measurement outcomes, which are these little like seismograph arrows at the top. You really have to use the measurement outcomes to modify the final qubit in order to do anything useful, okay? So there's no protocol that you're gonna get where the measurement outcomes just automatically spit the correct thing out. Always have to do some work to get the right qubit at the end. Okay, so you need measurements plus error correction on the final qubit. I'll describe the error correction process in some simple examples in a few minutes. But yeah, both measurement plus error correction enhances the Leib-Robinson velocity by a factor of m plus one. Okay, any questions before we continue?
Hello, is it overall like qubit-oriented things with m qubit and not, for example, bell power that consists from, for example, positron and electron?
I mean, the microscopic nature of what the qubits are is not important for what we're talking about. Yeah, I mean, I guess the only thing is I'm not assuming relativistic dynamics here. I'm willing to let information travel infinitely fast. So Einstein is not bothered at all at this point. From Einstein's perspective, I could send signals instantly fast. But even if you can send signals instantly fast, like you can instantly know what everyone measures, you still can't increase the velocity of quantum information arbitrarily fast, unless you're willing to make a sort of macroscopic number of measurements. That's the sort of key point. So there's a slower speed limit on quantum information than classical information. Okay. So now let me discuss some of the sort of mathematical formalism that we use to derive these results. This actually is not just a sort of technical part of the talk. I think this actually gives a very profound insight into why there is a sort of locality bound on dynamics, even in the presence of measurement. And will also sort of really elucidate why error correction is so critical. So to understand why this locality bound might exist, we sort of face a dilemma because we're interested in dynamics with measurements, right? And there's sort of two competing issues, I would say. On the one hand, we want to have a picture of operator dynamics because that's where locality is manifest. And in particular, right, we want to say that, well, if we teleported a qubit down the chain, it's sort of like the logical x and z on the initial qubit became the logical on some other qubit, maybe at site L instead of zero. So we want that locality picture in terms of operators. But measurement is most naturally understood, certainly in classes, in the context of states. And that's because measurement is typically thought of as a sort of violent process where you take the state psi, right, and you collapse it. So with some probability, you sort of choose it to become some subset of the original wave function, like you project it onto, you know, all the coefficient or all the terms in the wave function where maybe you have a zero on the first qubit. that's a very nonlinear process in the original Hilbert space, right? And so an operator like X naught, I have no idea how that transforms, and it probably can't even transform in a psi independent way on the original Hilbert space, okay? So there's this sort of tension between, on the one hand, states being totally non-local, and on the other hand, states somehow needing to be used to describe measurement. Now, what we're going to do is try to avoid this question or avoid this dilemma and look instead for a unitary realization of measurement. And this is possible, but you have to do this with a trick. So you have to basically append an extra qubit to the Hilbert space. And then you can actually find a sort of unitary realization of the measurement process. And this is what we're going to use to sort of understand Lieb-Robinson bounds. Let me make maybe one comment here that Dominic had asked earlier about, you know, can we think of measurement as entangling, you know, our physical qubit with some observer? And I think that's one kind of maybe more of a physics-friendly perspective for what we're doing here. I personally take the perspective that this is just a mathematical construction. I don't think, you know, I don't actually think of the sort of appended qubit as a physical thing. We'll indeed see that it plays a very special role. It's not on an equal footing in terms of what you're allowed to do to the physical qubits. So it's a more restricted sort of object. But we append this physical qubit in such a way that the measurement process will be unitary. In particular, if I start with a single qubit here depicted in blue, if I measure z, so z here will return plus one on the zero ket and minus one on the one ket. What I'm going to use my sort of measurement outcome extra qubit to do is essentially record whether I got plus one or minus one in the z measurement. And what will happen is that after measuring z, my new wave function will entangle the physical qubit with the measurement outcome, so that the wave function now reads alpha, zero, and then sort of twiddle zero, where the twiddle means this is a measurement outcome, and then beta one, twiddle one, okay? And this is now a unitary transformation, okay? But the price I had to pay in order to realize measurement in this way is I had to enlarge the physical Hilbert space, okay? Or if you prefer, you had to move beyond the physical Hilbert space into this sort of auxiliary Hilbert space called the Steinspring or dilated space, where you're using some of the qubits to record measurement outcomes. Okay.
Can I ask another question? This issue, you're saying that the, you know, you don't know how the operators transform. Wouldn't you have the same issue with dissipative systems? Dissipative systems, there's no natural operator map, I don't think. But, and yet, I think you mentioned that you...
No, there is. One can talk about operator dynamics under dissipative dynamics. And we'll be able to do it here. In some sense, for the same reason. Right. But yeah, this... In fact, here, everything is strictly unitary. So it's arguably easier than in the Lindblad picture.
Well, the Lindblad can also be thought of as some unitary dynamics in some way. Anyway, you can keep going.
Yeah, I don't disagree with what you're saying, but yeah, I will give you a very particular way that we do dynamics with measurement here that, you know, is usable. Okay. So, I guess I didn't call the measurement M on this previous slide, but this kind of math SF M, this is going to be a unitary transformation in the Steinspring Hilbert space that corresponds to the operation of making a measurement. And it's a C naught gate that couples, as I mentioned, the physical qubits to the Steinspring qubits. And we'll need its action on operators listed here. Okay, so when measurement in the Heisenberg picture, if you make a measurement, the X poly will pick up an X Steinspring poly that like flips the measurement outcome, right, from zero to one. Y will also pick up Steinspring X. Z and identity are invariant. They don't change at all. And Z twiddle, the poly that kind of tells us what we measured, this goes from twiddle Z to twiddle Z times logical Z. And that's a very important transformation, as we'll see. Now, the reason why you have to be very careful with these Steinspring qubits is that when a measurement happens, the Steinspring qubit has recorded the outcome, and it's sort of like a historical record. You cannot touch it anymore, okay? So it's a very special kind of qubit. It only is acted on sort of a single time. It can only be flipped once when you make the actual measurement. After that, it's just frozen in time forever, okay? This is sort of like a many worlds picture for quantum mechanics, because after that measurement is made, basically the like twiddle zero and twiddle one parts of the wave function evolve independently and they never interfere, okay? So if you want to make multiple measurements, you need multiple Steinspring qubits, okay? Anyway, we can now use either a Schrodinger or a Heisenberg picture for dynamics. If we have a protocol that involves some kind of mixture between unitary dynamics and measurement, that's denoted as P here. We can act that on a state in this auxiliary Hilbert space as P times psi, or we can use a Heisenberg picture where the state is just initialized to whatever it is and never moves. And instead, all the logical or all the operators are conjugated with P in this way. Okay. And these are equivalent pictures for quantum mechanics. The Heisenberg picture, in my view, is actually the nicer one for thinking about dynamics with measurements, because there's a very appealing feature of the Heisenberg picture. The physical states that we start with, if we go back here, right, we initialized them so the measurement outcome was always zero. I mean, didn't have to be, but that was just the choice we made. And once we've made that choice, we have to stick with it, okay? And so all the states that we care about will have Steinspring zeros. And what that means is that if we evolve an operator O and we happen to pick up a twiddle X, then that operator is sort of deadly. It means that information is destroyed by the measurement irretrievably, okay? So anything with twiddle X, you have to avoid at all costs if you want to save quantum information and do a useful task, okay? And this is sort of helpful as a guide to the eye in some sense for thinking about how one is going to design protocols that are enhanced by measurement, okay? What we are allowed to do in the Steinspring picture, and this is why it's very powerful, is we are allowed to have Steinspring Zs in our operator O. What that means is that we're doing something that calls upon the outcome of a measurement and sort of modifies, you know, the resulting transformation accordingly. So it's basically encoding for us the prospect of doing error correction. So the operator O, as I'll show an example of momentarily, will encode for us an error corrected operation on our state, okay? And it's that possibility being realized, I think, quite naturally that makes this a very powerful formalism. Okay. So let me show you how this works in action. So here I have a Bell pair, which is encoding a physical, one logical qubit, okay? And right, this is the initial state. So the Steinspring qubit is initialized in zero twiddle. And this is kind of like a parity check state, right? The alpha terms are even parity, the beta terms are an odd parity Bell pair. And I now want to measure out the second qubit and do error correction in such a way that my final state becomes, you know, alpha zero plus beta one on the first qubit, tensored into something that will be an entangled state between qubit two and the Steinspring outcome, okay? So the goal is to arrive at this kind of unentangled state, right? I want quantum information not to be entangled with the measurement outcome because I want to actually access it at the end, okay? I can achieve this without any unitary dynamics or, well, maybe, okay, without any two-body unitary dynamics, okay, I can make a measurement denoted here in orange. So by measuring Z2, I apply this kind of C0-like gait that entangles qubit 2 with sine spring. And then R denotes error correction. And in this case, what R is going to do is it's going to flip the first qubit, basically, if I measured a 1 on the second qubit. And we can sort of see why that would make sense. If I measured 0 on the second qubit, just looking at the starting wave function, I just immediately collapse into alpha 0 plus beta 1. But if I measure 1, right, I flipped the alpha and beta, and I need to correct that in R by applying x1 if z twiddle is minus 1, meaning I measured a 1 in qubit 2. So you can explicitly see on the state that this transformation indeed does what we need. But what's nice is we can also see this by in the Heisenberg picture, right? Purely by thinking about operator dynamics. In the Heisenberg picture, if you take logical x1, so you take the final logical operator that acts on just one qubit, the place where information is at the end, right? And now we evolve it backwards in time under Heisenberg dynamics. And in the case of x1, we just find that it's invariant. But in the case of z1, we find that z1 gets modified by r in this error correcting step, and then modified again by m, such that the final z operator is z1 times z2 times z twiddle. When this operator acts on the initial state, that z twiddle is a 1, we can kind of ignore it. But if we focus on the orange parts of the operator, we see that in the Heisenberg picture, the logical x and z on the final qubit, right, just in slot 1, have evolved as they need to into the logical operators on the entangled Bell pair state we started with. So logical x is indeed just flipping the first qubit. But the logical z on psi of 0 is z1 times z2, okay? And we sort of see in this Steinspring picture that that logicals evolved into logicals in the presence of measurement. It was crucial for that to happen, right, that we used knowledge of the measurement outcome. Basically, we included that Steinspring z twiddle in order to basically seed that physical poly z2 necessary to grow our logical operator from Z1 to Z1, Z2. Okay. So this is sort of a simple example of how error correction is done in this Steinspring formalism. Let me make a couple comments to try and connect what we're doing now to existing literature. So, one thing which I think is very manifest in the story that I've just told, right, is that you really had to do error correction in order to protect a single qubit. So if I wanted to grow logical operators on my final qubit into logicals on the initial state, I had to do error correction. And that's essentially equivalent to the statement that there's a no cloning theorem in quantum mechanics, okay? So if I want to protect that initial qubit, I can't just sort of keep doing the experiment over and over again until I get the right measurement outcome. In this previous example, if I measure 0, then I don't have to do error correction. I can just go away and I get the right state. But if I measure 1, right, I had to do this error correction step. And you basically are not allowed in quantum mechanics, because of the no cloning theorem, to just keep trying until you get the right measurement outcome, okay? As a consequence, to do anything interesting, you must do error correction. If you don't, then it's effectively like, well, you weren't using measurements at all, you were just studying the dynamics of a dissipative system. If you don't do error correction, so there's no twiddled X or Z in your operators, you can effectively think of trying to trace out the Steinspring part of the Hilbert space. And the dynamics will all go through, except for that when you make measurements, you will have to sort of project out certain operators. It's sort of like a Lindblad-like dynamics. For measuring Z, for example, you would project out any operator, you just delete any operator that has a poly X or Y. And so then the old Lee-Robinson bounds apply to this. Measurement doesn't help you to do anything fast. There's sort of no error correction. There's nothing useful that happens. Measurement is truly just dangerous. Okay, it just destroys information, but never helps. So it's crucial that you actually use knowledge of these measurement outcomes, basically that you use these Z twiddles as part of the unitary dynamics in the Steinspring-Hilbert space in order to achieve some useful task like a quantum repeater, okay? And if one goes to this literature on measurement-induced phase transitions, our conclusions will still hold. If you want to do some interesting task, you can't just sort of keep trying until you get the right measurement outcomes. That's unphysical. You won't save any quantum information. You need to get it right the first time. And that will not happen in the thermodynamic limit, right? Just the probability is exponentially suppressed that all the measurement outcomes are desirable. And so if you want to do something interesting, you really have to do error correction and find a sort of feedback algorithm that corrects for all the measurements. And I suspect what this means is that, you know, this any sort of interesting phase of matter that's maybe prepared in the assistance of measurements is effectively just a kind of error correcting code. Okay. So that's maybe a bit of a philosophical aside, but I think it's something that when you think about it in this Steinspring formalism becomes pretty clear. Okay. Anyway, so going back to our theorem, now that we have this Steinspring picture, we can really see without too much work why both the Lee-Robinson velocity gets to be enhanced in the presence of measurement, but also why it's not enhanced arbitrarily much. Okay. So the dynamics that we want, right, is to start with a logical operator acting on a final qubit. Let's say if we want to do teleportation. And then the goal is to show that under this kind of reverse time evolution in the Heisenberg picture, this final logical operator will grow into a logical acting on the initial site, okay? So let's sort of see schematically how that might happen. In the quantum repeater algorithm that I described before, you know, we had unitary dynamics on a state followed by making measurements of Bell pairs, followed by doing this error correction step. And I didn't really describe error correction before, I just said it had to be done. Now let's see why it had to be done. In the Heisenberg picture, the first thing that we do, right, is error correction on the final qubit. And this is gonna be sort of schematically rotating XF and rotating XF in a way that depends on all the measurement outcomes. Schematically, the operator that we'll get after this is a logical XF multiplied by a bunch of Steinspring Zs. Then we do measurement, and measurement, right, will take each of these Steinspring Zs and it will spit out a physical logical, or a physical poly rather, basically at the location that was measured, okay? So what measurements and error correction have done for us is basically they've allowed us in a finite time step to take the logical XF and to grow it into a kind of non-local operator, okay? So effectively, the use of QEC and measurement allows us to instantly seed physical poly strings that are completely non-local and that are as non-local as we want in space, okay? And then in the last step of the repeater, for example, we apply unitary dynamics. And this unitary doesn't touch the Steinspring qubits, so those stay Z twiddle J's, but they can of course evolve the physical polys XF ZJ. And our goal is that what this unitary does is it takes XF times some product of ZJ's, and our goal is it converts that into X on the initial site multiplied by some stabilizer for the initial state, okay? So in the repeater algorithm, we would want XI times a product of Z's on other qubits, okay? And again, in this picture, I hope it's sort of very clear that the measurement outcomes have to be used, okay? Because it's only through the error correction step that we're able to kind of seed these other polys non-locally in space. And ultimately, that's what's going to allow us to beat the Lee-Robinson bound. Pictorially, what happens is the following. So on the right here, and at the top of the picture, right, we start with a logical operator on the final site. And after the blue and orange steps, after measurement plus error correction, we can seed some poly Zs, right, non-locally, sort of anywhere we want in the chain. And now I claim that in order to actually transmit information successfully, we need to wait long enough for the light cones emitted by sort of all of these operators, or if you prefer, we need to wait long enough for the poly strings that grow in this backwards time evolution from every measurement site. We need to wait until all of those light cones can intersect, okay? In this quantum repeater example that we saw before, when this intersection happens, we will basically take x, z, z on the top, and we will convert it into z, z, and then an x on the far left, okay? Why do these light cones need to touch? Well, if I want to transmit a logical qubit from one end to the other, I need to take a non-commuting x and z pair, right, from the far right, and I need to move them to a non-commuting X and Z pair on the far left. But I can't have any residual non-commutativity in the middle of the chain. Because if I do, then what that means is the protocol will only succeed if I give you a highly entangled state to begin with. But if I want the protocol to work, you know, given a product state, given a product initial state, then I'd better make sure that the logical operators only act in a non-commuting fashion, at any rate, on a single site. What that means is that it's not enough to break the Lee-Robinson theorem by basically taking the logical xn and doing this quote-unquote error-correcting step by measuring something on the first qubit, and then sort of adjusting xn based on that outcome. So if you do this kind of fake process where in sort of forward time, you measure the first qubit and then rotate the final one based on the outcome, you will indeed grow your poly string to something non-local. So Lee-Robinson commutators are so large, but you haven't teleported a qubit, right? Because you still would have an X and a Z on the final site that fail to commute. So basically the only states in which you would have a logical qubit on site N are states where you started with the logical qubit on site N. What you need to have happen, and this is where the light cone intersection becomes important, is you need to make sure that the site where X and Z fail to commute basically can be pushed all the way to X1. And what happens at the intersection of these light cones is basically that we try to take non-commuting operators at, let's say, the left end of the right triangle, and we try to multiply them in such a way that we kind of jump the non-commutativity to the left end of the middle triangle. And you can kind of, you know, the more measurements you have, the more you can do this, but all the measurement light cone, or all the light cones have to touch in order for non-commutativity to get pushed all the way from N to the initial site one. And that's the origin of this Lee-Robinson bound in the presence of measurements, okay? The number of measurements you have tells you kind of the number of light cones you get to use to jump, thus enhancing the Lee-Robinson velocity by roughly m. We can also do this for non-Clifford dynamics. The proof is sort of similar, although very technical in that case. So to sort of recap, right, we've proved the main result that I advertised. The Lee-Robinson velocity is enhanced by a factor of m in the presence of measurements plus error correction. Now, I think a lot of people will say at this point that who cares, because you can make m of order l, and then t is of order one. And this sort of means that once you're allowed to use measurements, And even like one measurement, you know, per site, you can already do something very non-local. So in this sense, I think a lot of people say that measurement kind of completely destroys locality. But what I'd like to emphasize is that in the Steinspring picture, it's very clear that in order for this to work, you must basically use up the entire spin chain and prepare it in a finely tuned initial state so that the error correction step works and you are successful. Okay. In this sense, I think you should really think there's a genuine trade-off between the time it takes to implement your unitary dynamics versus the sort of amount of resources and measurements that you're going to use to try and speed it up. If you want to do something and prepare a long-range entangled bell pair in order one time, you're going to have to use a thermodynamic number of sort of extra qubits as resources in order to make that happen. And you know, you'll need to do the error correction perfectly for all L sort of measurements that you make, okay? If you make mistakes in any one of those measurements, you destroy all the quantum information. And so in practice, right, you would need to sort of have some active error correction scheme on top of what is described here. And this is sort of why quantum computing is hard. One thing that is also maybe clear from this light cone picture is that you want to make the measurements at the very end, right, to send information as fast as possible, because you want these light cones to grow as big as they can. There are algorithms where it helps to measure in intermediate time steps instead, and then modify unitary dynamics afterwards. This is called feed forward. But it turns out that for Lieb-Robinson bounds, it doesn't help. Okay. So you basically, for trying to send information as fast as possible, you should always wait until the very end to do measurements. As one final remark I'd like to make, if you try to ask, you know, can I at least beat the spirit of this theorem by sending lots of qubits for the price of one, you know, you might ask whether this is possible. And it turns out the answer is no. Okay. So you need to use basically M measurement outcomes for every qubit you want to send if you want to enhance the Lieb-Robinson velocity by this factor of M plus one. And roughly the reason why is if you thought this theorem was false, then you would be able to find just one logical qubit that could be transmitted with fewer than M plus one measurements and thus violate the one qubit theorem that we described. Okay. So, you know, the more qubits you want to send, sort of the more measurement outcomes necessary to do error correction, again, just emphasizing that measurements are not a free resource. Okay. And we've almost proved this kind of multi-qubit extension in all possible cases, except in this case, the feed-forward bound is just too technically exhausting. And so we weren't able to prove that no matter sort of what time-dependent protocol you use, you can't beat this sort of M plus one enhancement to the light cone speed. But we do believe that theorem is correct. We just haven't proved it for all possible dynamics. Okay. Actually, at this point, how much time do I have left?
I think we are not strict in the time limit, but maybe, I don't know, 10 minutes or 15 minutes or so.
Okay. That should be enough time. I can actually even end a little bit.
Sure.
Yeah. So, okay. So let me just sort of describe quickly some applications of what we're doing. You know, for much of the talk, I've kind of focused on either trying to prepare bell pairs or teleport qubits. But these bounds sort of immediately rule out a lot of desirable tasks that you might have hoped to speed up with measurements and maybe sloppy error correction. So one thing you might hope, for example, is that you can efficiently prepare not a bell pair, but a GHZ like cat state. You know, where you start maybe from unentangled qubits, and after, you know, some finite time plus measurements, et cetera, you prepare alpha times all zeros plus beta times all ones. So this is sort of many body state, but it doesn't have so much entanglement. So you might think it's not so difficult to prepare. But it turns out this obeys exactly the same bound that we described before. So if you only want to make m measurements, basically you can only cut the time by a factor of m plus one. Okay. And again, for every measurement that you make, you need to use its outcome for error correction, otherwise it's useless. You can also show that there's no way, as a sort of corollary of our result, there's no way to transform efficiently between GHZ and Bell states using any combination of measurement, unitary, feed forward, et cetera. These are basically like a Bell pair and a GHZ state are just two different kinds of entanglement that are very difficult to transform between. Okay. Another application is to W states. So W states are just a different kind of famous entangled state where instead of alpha times all zeros plus beta times all ones, now we have beta times this kind of shared state where you have a single one, but it's kind of in a superposition of being found on any of the N sites, or maybe L sites should have used. For preparing this W state, it turns out we certainly know that our bound must hold. So you can't beat this M plus one VT greater than L, but we actually don't have a saturating protocol for this. We're off by basically two powers of log L. And we're sort of trying to work to understand whether one can just find a fancier protocol or whether somehow we can actually prove that the W state is a harder state to prepare than GHZ. And I'm certainly not an expert on either of these two states, so maybe someone can tell me the answer to why. But I would say we sort of believe that it's probably a bit harder to prepare the W state. And hopefully we'll have some results on that soon. Just to keep going down the list, we can also bound the time to prepare squeezed states. So these are some practical value in AMO, for kind of precision measurements and precision sensing. A squeezed state is, you can think of it as a state where you have a sort of finite expectation value for spin in the Z direction. And then maybe we try to choose Jx to be, by Heisenberg uncertainty principle, we can't know the value of either Jx or Jy exactly, but maybe we know the value of Jx like very, very accurately. It turns out the Heisenberg uncertainty principle says we could know it sort of up to order one over L. And so you can ask, how easy is it to prepare that kind of squeeze state? And R bound again applies to this problem. And it's saturated by a sort of embarrassing protocol, at least in the absence of measurements, where you just kind of tensor together lots of independent squeeze states. But what we do rule out is measurement cannot be used, at least in an unsophisticated way, to speed up the preparation of squeeze states beyond what you can do with unitary dynamics. Lastly, since SPT states can be used to as a resource for teleportation and measurement-based quantum computing, we can also rule out the ease with which one can prepare interesting SPT states, and or maybe a little more precisely, the ease with which one can decode from an SPT phase using measurements. So if you, after some finite time, unitary dynamics, go from a product state to some SPT state, you will need to use an extensive number of measurements to decode that state or to teleport, the logical qubit somewhere else in the chain. Okay. All right. So let me sort of wrap up and then can take a few more questions if anyone has them. So the punchline of the talk is that we've been able to generalize, I think, the best that we can, notions of locality and Lieb-Robinson bounds to dynamics in the presence of measurement. So if you start with an unentangled initial state, you can sort of beat the Lee-Robinson bound by a factor of m plus one, as long as you're willing to make m local measurements and do error correction with the outcome of every single measurement. And this bound is optimal and saturated by this quantum repeater protocol. Okay. So there's sort of nothing better that you can do than this simple, just prepare Bell pairs and measure them. And this theorem constrains the preparation of basically every resource state that I think you would be interested in. And I think it, you know, it gives us limits, for example, on how easy it is to prepare various error correcting codes with unitary dynamics. Okay. I think just to end on some interesting open questions that I hope one can use our formalism to help answer in the future. I think these bounds, you know, I hope at least they can be used to sort of suggest optimal solutions to certain hardware design questions. Like if you want to trade off between the runtime for your gates versus, you know, the amount of overhead needed to do error correction or the length of repeater chains, et cetera, you know, these theorems tell us sort of how much error correction is needed and how many kind of auxiliary resource qubits will be necessary to use measurement to speed up the implementation of any gate. And so perhaps one can really sort of figure out optimal trade-offs, you know, given various microscopic considerations about, you know, fidelities of gates and decoherence rates, et cetera. And similarly, I think it's not obvious to me sort of the extent to which measurements will actually help to do useful tasks in the near future. I think it may be sort of more limited than people had first thought, or maybe not, you know, maybe I'm too pessimistic. But I think that these kinds of theorems can hopefully help to give us a precise sense of kind of what the power and limitations of measurement are in combination with unitary dynamics. So. All right, that's all I wanted to say. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks so much for the nice talk. Yeah, so feel free to unmute yourself for asking questions. Tom raised a hand, so yeah, just feel free to ask questions.
Sure, yeah, thank you for a very nice talk. I was wondering, are there any implications for preparing topologically ordered systems in 2+1D or in 3+1D? Maybe I think I'm not an expert in this preparation stuff. A lot of people in the audience are have written a lot of interesting papers. And I was, if the speed is enhanced by a factor of L, if I do N or order L measurements, unless they're in 2+1D, but most of the protocols people are doing are where the measurements are extensive, like order L square, if I understood correctly. So the you think, does it suggest some possibility of doing only order L measurements in 2+1D to prepare, let's say, some state or maybe that's
I mean, we can't rule that out, but I strongly doubt that it's possible. I mean, there may just be other considerations. I think roughly what would make it difficult is that probably I'm also not an expert on these topological state preparation questions, but my guess is that you need to be able to move, let's say, your logical qubit sort of everywhere in the system. And then I think you're just not going to get around needing kind of
right. That's my naive guess.
One measurement
kind of string can be everywhere. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So the I see. And another question I had, maybe this is a bit more general, maybe harder question than, are there any examples where Lee-Robinson bound gives some useful information about states which whose complexity is, let's say exponential or something like that, something much larger than L or something super polynomial? Are there any interesting,
I think, so, okay, my expectation is that, you know, I can maybe answer a slightly different question, which I think is related, although I'm not sure. But if you wanted to use measurement, for example, to speed up the preparation of some highly entangled state, so not just like a Bell pair or
right.
et cetera, or GHZ, that's impossible. Basically because of this constraint that there are a number of ways to see this, but if I go back here, right? So to make a sort of highly complex state, I need to send, you can sort of imagine I need to send like order L qubits. And then even if you use a large number of qubits, the number of measurements needed is so large that effectively you should just use unitary dynamics because mm-hmm. you can only measure L qubits at a time.
Yeah, I understand.
You need to do that L times. Mm-hmm. So I think we can sort of say that probably measurements really only help you to prepare quote unquote like simple or low entanglement mm-hmm. States. Mm-hmm. And maybe now we have a slightly more quantitative set of rules for like, what do we mean by that? Like how complicated does the state need to be to get a given enhancement?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, makes sense. Thank you.
Can I ask a question? I have two general questions. Sure. One is if you consider non-local measurements, can you improve this bound?
Yeah, so I mean, if you measure something non-local, then you can, I think you can completely break the Lee-Robinson bound. I mean, it's sort of unfair because, you know, you could start with unentangled qubits and do a sort of Bell basis measurement between the two qubits that you want to put in a Bell pair. And that one measurement does the job, right? And then the worst case is you would need to do some error correction on that Bell pair to put it in the desired form, but that could be done locally.
Uh-huh.
Or at least,
instance, if you consider non-local measurement acting on the two physical qubits, how much can you improve this bound?
It completely goes away. There is no bound
anymore. Oh, really? Uh-huh.
As I said, I mean, it's like if you have unentangled qubits and you can measure, for example, like, are my initial and final qubit in the Bell pair 00 plus 11, 00 minus 11, 01 plus 10, et cetera. And you can make the measurement in such a way that it just instantly prepares the entangled Bell pair for you. It's sort of trivial, right? Because we sort of engineered the desired state we wanted to be the eigenbasis of our measurement. So I think this is only meaningful if the measurements also have to be local, which is, I think, a physical sort of requirement in many
states. I see. Okay. And I have another question. So you started from an entangled initial state. For instance, if you start from some ground state quantum metabolic system, you expect some non-maximally entangled state. So in such a case, do you expect a similar bound?
So yeah, we have a few comments on this in our paper. So if you have some kind of, again, maybe this answer is sort of silly, but you know, if you imagine that there's some finite time or quasi-local protocol, for example, that can prepare your ground state from a product state, then our bound holds because you just kind of have to subtract that preparation time from T, but if it's order one, then just an order one number. I mean, it's possible that if you have like a CFT ground state, then maybe there's some logs that you can save. Like maybe you only need L over log L on the right side. Although I doubt that you're going to get it, you know, like you're going to completely trivialize the bounds. I suspect even in a state that has, you know, a little bit more than area law entanglement, it's probably not enough. But
okay.
I think that's an open problem, at least for me.
So. Thank you.
Can I ask a question? Thanks for the great talk. And so I had a question about, so with this understanding, can you make a claim about the nature of the volume law phase in this measurement induced phases? Like whether is it like some in some sense fragile, or like even though it's volume law, the entanglement is in some sense fragile? Is that
Okay, maybe I should preface what I'm going to say with this is very speculative, but I believe the answer is yes in the following sense. So, right, what we've shown is that error correction is really essential. And so in some sense, it's maybe a little tricky to analyze some of these measurement-induced protocols, because maybe what you really want to think is happening is that there's somehow like some creative decoding algorithm that, you know, at the end of your circuit, you go look at like all LT measurement outcomes, mm-hmm. and then you do something crazy to your state. And so I think maybe to answer a slightly different question, I mean, the reason I believe that the volume law phase is in a sense fragile, what I think is fragile is the decoding scheme. Like
right.
The decoding scheme will just be so ridiculous that it's not, that the phase isn't useful for anything in the same way that like your, you know, computer is a volume law entangled state being at room temperature. It doesn't mean it's a quantum computer or a quantum error correcting code. So I think it's kind of the same issue that those phases will run into. It may be that there are phases where there's kind of one qubit that is easy to decode. And I think that will sort of come back to this remark I made that maybe, you know, really what these phases will end up being is some kind of like, it's a new way of thinking about phases of different schemes for error correction and kind of different families of codes. But I think from our, yeah, I mean, one thing I would say is we don't really look at entanglement directly because it's not an easy thing to look at mm-hmm. in the Stein spring picture. In the Stein spring picture, what's really natural are sort of these kinds of single shot error corrected observables. But I would say in my defense, you know, like those are the interesting experimental observables. So
mm-hmm. for sure.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay, so I think we can have more discussion later because Andrew will stay here for longer after this formal talk. So, but right now, maybe let me just thank Andrew again for the last talk.